Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 25 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we ask a writer to root around in our archive and pick out a story to read and discuss with me. On this month's episode, I'm joined by novelist and critic Kevin Powell, who was chosen to read from Emer Ryan's Body Clock. Body Clock was published in issue 14, volume 2 of the Stinging Fly magazine in 2019. Kevin Power is the author of White City, published in 2021, and Bad Day in Black Rock, later made into the film What Richard Did by Denny Abrahamson. His essays and criticism have appeared in The New Yorker, The Guardian, The Irish Times, The New York Review of Books, and in a collection of his criticism, The Written Word, published in 2022. He has contributed reviews to the website and delivered the annual lecture with his piece Attempted Rescues, Notes on Writing. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're our first in-studio guest.
It's an honour.
Thanks for coming. Would you like to read from Emer's story? Then we could talk about it a little bit.
I will. Body Clock by Emer Ryan. Sometimes they scare me, the intense feelings you can have for a stranger, the sudden rush of affection for a kid in a supermarket hiding from his parents, or for an old man in a coffee shop blessing himself after finishing a muffin. Sometimes it's a pointless rage towards the teenage girls on the bus with the mocking laughs or the guy who asks you for a light when you're sitting outside a cafe having lunch with your friends. Yes, you light his fag and he'll lean in and cup your hand so it's weirdly intimate, but all you want to say is, call yourself a smoker. By the next day, you've forgotten these people. But for a few moments, they overwhelm you, short the circuit boards of your brain. Right now I'm on the train going from Logan Airport to the Back Bay. I'm in the standing space, trying to shrink, make my suitcase look smaller than it is. Passengers trying to get past keep stumbling over me. I wait for the sighs of impatience, muted glares, but the people here don't go in for that much. If I was anyone else on this train, I would hate me. I'm sitting in the broad back of my suitcase in Copley Square. If I tilt my head back as far as it will go, I can just about see the top of the John Hancock Tower looking like a beaker filled with lagoon water. It's autumn, hot, and I wait, feeling my skin heat up and harden watching teenagers ollie past no skateboarding signs. I'm waiting for Orla, who is 17 years older than me, 4 inches shorter and 30 pounds lighter. She offered to meet me at the airport, but I like Boston. I want to experience some of it alone. I see Orla when she's about 50 yards away. We experience that awkwardness where you sight someone from far away and have to maintain the enthusiasm until they're right up to you. When is the right time to wave, to call out? 20 yards? 10? Hey, Jules, she yells from 15 yards. She always knows the right time. She is wearing all black on a scorcher of a day. Her smile would be a beautiful one if not for the stains. It's the smile I'll probably have in 20 years. I have a sudden wish to have Orla around all the time just for that smile. It's the one thing that could wean me off smoking. We cross the square to a cafe where Orla knows the owner quite well. Sure enough, we get a complimentary bottle of wine. She looks across the table at me, sizing me up in some way. To avoid the eye contact, I check the bottle's label, 06 Rioja. It means nothing to me, but Orla seems put out by the wine's vintage and origin. She fusses and apologizes and pours large glasses, adding, I've got better stuff at home. I'm buoyed by her slight discomfiture and don't bother to tell her that my rough palate makes no distinction between 7 euro swill from Spar and a swanky restaurant's house wine. I should point out that I'm not a bad person. I want her to come away from this visit believing that we bonded. I just hope it doesn't take too much out of me. After we order, Orla clasps her hands and sighs in a way that is meant to evoke deep satisfaction. So, I reply dutifully. How's Niall? Good form, you know dad-like. Yes, irrepressible, she rolls her eyes, trying to disguise it by leaning forward to sip her wine. And, oh, who was that charming friend of yours at your 18th, Dermot? Dermot. Yeah, can't wait to get back to college. We're going to be living together again this year. She stops sipping. Ooh, are you sleeping together? Oh God, no. Why ever not? He's cute and you, honey, you've got that certain appeal. It isn't like that. Like what? This is gorgeous. I spear some of my prawn salad and offer her some, but she just looks at me and won't let me take the conversation off on the tangent I wanted to go. Thing about Dermot is he sleeps with everyone he knows, except me. It's like his mark of respect or something. Is he gay? Not exactly. She smiles again, briefly flashing those nicotine teeth. I should photograph those teeth. I thought so, she says, dropping her voice. At your party, you know, we both went to the back kitchen to fetch your cake. Oh, it was nothing really, a silly thing. The candles wouldn't light and he made some stupid joke, but I thought he was flirting with me. I am reminded that, though I don't see her too often, and though we are often mistaken for sisters, these are not the reasons I sometimes forget she's my mother.
Thank you, Kevin. Oh, the dialogue. I hadn't actually read this story. This one of the great things about doing the podcast is I never have read the story usually. Can you tell me why you picked it?
I was looking through the archives and I saw Emer's name, and I know Emer is a great writer. Years ago, I first met Emer years ago. I think this is the first time we met, where we both won a Hennessy Award in the same year, in 2009. I remember reading her story, her winning story, and I every time I see her name on a story since, I read it. Now, of course, she's published a wonderful novel called Holding Her Breath, came out a couple of years ago, which I think didn't get as much attention as it should have. Mm-hmm. And she's just published a memoir with the brilliant title of The Grass Ceiling, which is about being a woman playing sports, GAA specifically, which I haven't read yet, and I can't wait to read it because I know she's just such a lucid and intelligent and charming writer, and a writer who's sort of deceptively easy to read. She drops in these gorgeous touches and they're like nothing, and she doesn't overdo it. I remember reading a story of hers years ago, in which she describes a judge sitting in a kind of cocktail bar, or a lawyer, I can't remember. It's a long time since I read the story, but I remember the line. And he's still wearing his wig. And the narrator of the story says his wig was like a vestigial brain. I just think that's really nice. And it's such a good image. It's stuck with me ever since. Because why is it a good image? Because it's visually, like, you know, accurate. That's kind of what they look like. But also, lawyers and judges do have a vestigial brain, the law, right? They have this body of knowledge that they kind of carry about with them. And it's just that kind of writing is, you know, those images are surprisingly rare. And writers chase them all the time, the ones that are going to stick with you and change the way you see something kind of slightly ever afterward. And there's one in here where she describes the John Hancock Tower as like a beaker full of lagoon water. That's exactly what it looks like. If you've been to Boston and you've seen it, it is. That is exactly what it resembles. And it's, you know, she doesn't overdo it. She's not, you know, this kind of flashy stylist, particularly. She doesn't bombard you with these brilliant imagery, bits of imagery. This is something I've been thinking about recently, trying to get my own work to be better, as we all are all the time.
And I want mine to be worse.
Well, that's a nice problem to have. No, it's too good, Nicole. It's just too good. You have to dial it back. You're making it hard for the rest of us.
I agree that, like, what Emer does here is, like, I think you phrased it nicely there when it's deceptively easy to read. Like, I read that story once and I was like, oh. And then when you go back and you reread it, there's so much in there. And even that conversation between her and the aunt, she really captures that dynamic really, like, very, very brilliantly. And I do wonder, because I feel I can't write that way. I do wonder how writers like that do it. You know, I think that it's a sort of gift.
Me too. Absolutely. This kind of writing is sort of mysterious to me. Because you read it and when I say it feels like nothing, what I mean is that you read it without, you've absorbed its kind of emotional impact almost before you've noticed. And that, you know, that's that kind of writing I have a huge admiration for. And one of the things this story does is kind of destabilize you at every point. You know, you don't know what the relationship between these two women is until you begin to suspect it, but then suddenly it's revealed to you halfway through or after a few paragraphs. And I think that that's a really interesting bit of kind of formal, you know, maneuvering that she's doing there. And I think it's just, she's just really perceptive about the relationships between mothers and daughters.
And also between, you know, I her narrator is sort of hard to gauge. I really enjoy the work that does that. And she's sort of mean, as in the is a simple word, but you get the feeling she's extremely difficult as well. I really feel like another story could be then written from the aunt's perspective, where she's just, you know, kind of sullen, you know, sort of thoughtless. There's a great line. She says, "But a part of me that cringes and balks at the moment that most people, maybe rightly, regard as being the stuff of a good life." And when I went back through it line by line, I think that's like very, very tricky to just sort of pull off. We were this sort of unstable narrator, or certainly hard to gauge. And I was thinking you do something similar in White City, which I read, I think my memory won't be perfect, but I read it maybe 2 years ago. Mm. But yeah, can you talk a bit about how you did that? Or
it's the great trick with a first person narrator is how do you get the reader to see them as if from the outside? And it's one of the main things you need to think about, I think, mm-hmm. when you have a first person narrator. Because it's very easy to be seduced by a first-person voice if it's any good, you're doing it right, and that's a really tricky thing to do. I mean, one of the key bits in White City actually is, and no one's kind of pointed it out to my face as it were, is there's a bit where he looks at his girlfriend's phone, Cleo's phone, and her recent searches, and one of them is in a relationship with a narcissist. What do? And people who have and he kind of thinks nothing of it. He just mentions and throws it away. Yeah. Why? Because he's nice. Yeah. And this, you know, you can do it in indirect details like that. You can give readers a sense of how the other characters see this character, privately assess this character rather than, you know, directly assess them. And Emer does a really, really good job of doing that here. You're absolutely right. We do get a sense that from the mother's perspective, this girl might be sullen, uncooperative, hard to reach, depressive, you know, kind of manic, all of these things. And so it's brilliantly done in that the failures on both sides of kind of empathy and communication are there.
And she's very resentful, clearly, of this relationship, this non-relationship she has with this guy, but is unwilling to do anything about it. I think that's a... I also just love in fiction generally when two characters who like are having the totally different conversation, like they're having it, but there's like another conversation up on top of that. And Emer writes the dialogue there so brilliantly. Yeah. It's very funny. Yeah. They just can't communicate properly at all,
and that's so hard to do without lapsing into total banality. Yeah. You know, because it is really, really hard to write dialogue that sounds offhand and casual, yet strained, you know, at the same time, and actually contains behind it that other hidden conversation. It's very difficult to do. She's a really deft writer of that kind of stuff. Yeah.
You mentioned that you both won Hennessy Prize in 2008, 2000, and
I think it was 2009, I think.
So you were writing stories around then.
Yes.
And how did you first start? Why did you want to write a short story? That's the main question.
For fame, glamour.
Oh, the money.
Success, the money. The money. There's great money in short stories. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
was there a good like short story kind of culture in Ireland at that time? Like I think the Stinging Fly was around.
Yeah. It was
Was there a Little Kingdoms out by then?
Was it? Was that 07? So yeah, I think it might have been.
Like it was, yeah,
I feel like it
so
was.
So was there an exciting time to kind of write choice
stories? Yeah. And I mean, you know, without wanting to kind of do myself down too much, I don't find the short story a particularly natural form to work in. You know, I don't know why that should be. But I keep going back to it, which is the funny thing. I'm writing them right now. Mm. And kind of reading Emer's story kind of made me go, bloody hell, you know, there's a level of kind of concentration in a good short story that I find hard to do. And maybe it's just because I'm a kind of, you know, I'm just a slower thinker and I'm more of a ramblier thinker. I need more space to kind of say what I'm trying to say, which is either a fault or an advantage, I don't know. But yeah, there was when in 2009 or 2008, whenever it was. Yeah, that it was really beginning. The Stinging Fly had been on the scene for not quite a decade at that point. And in fact, they published my first short story.
Oh, brilliant.
In 2004, which means that next year is my 20th anniversary as a published writer.
That's amazing. What was it about?
It was... so everyone's first short story is about family dynamics with an animal metaphor. Isn't that true? And,
yes, I think so.
And my first short story was no different. Yeah. I'm too embarrassed to even describe it further than that. So I think I was 21 when I wrote it.
21.
And it is very much a short story by a 21-year-old.
Did it take you long to write it? Did you feel like it was a big read? Did you feel you learned something by writing it?
Funny, no, because I had sent Declan stories before that he had sent back, and you know, with very wonderful, encouraging notes, you know, which was an amazing thing to get when you're kind of starting out. And Declan is, as an editor, he is one of those editors who, you know, responds to you.
Yeah,
he's amazing like that, and gives you something useful. But I sent him that story, kind of going, he'll say no to this. And I'd spent a few weeks on it, tinkering with it, trying to get it right, and not feeling I had, actually. Mm. And I just kind of sent it off because I was sick of looking at it and I couldn't do anything with it. And yeah, he accepted it. And, you know, he called me up and then went through it with me almost line by line on the phone.
Oh, that's very nice.
And that was what I learned more from than anything else, I think, than writing the story in the first place.
Stephen Fry actually rejected my first short story before.
I can't believe that.
I can't believe it either. And I worked in a card shop at the time. And I posted it. I sent it in a very nice envelope. I was like, if they don't accept it with this envelope, they're never going to accept it. So yes, I feel that kind of what was happening in Ireland at the time. You write very well about, you know, the Celtic Tiger and things like that. Did you feel that influence like your short stories? And can you see, when Emer wrote this in like 2009, can you see the kind of Ireland she's writing about? Or do you think it has any effect on the story? Or do you think it's just about the family dynamics?
It's funny. I mean, she's got an Irish person and take them out of Ireland, right? And
put them
at physical distance from Ireland. And the sense we get of Ireland from the story is quite oblique. Mm. You know, it might peep at you between the lines, but I don't know that I get it necessarily a strong sense. I think this is a story, you know, that this isn't a kind of, you know, tract about social conditions. It's a story about kind of a few moments of beautifully observed emotion between two people. I don't know. Emer's novel, Holding Her Breath, it would be hard to read it as, you know, this we have this compulsive tendency to read everything as a kind of, you know, read everything under the kind of economic umbrella, and sort of say, well, what's this saying about, you know, capitalism in Ireland and, you know, the post-recession novel, all that kind of stuff. And that's useful to a point and interesting up to a point. But, you know, it's not all the novel does or is interested in doing. And I think Emer is very much a writer who's interested in emotional dynamics before she's interested in that
stuff.
Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. I mean, she might correct me, of course, but I don't know. I mean, I am drawn to writing about social stuff, you know, in that way. And it's because I've absorbed, you know, a huge dose of like a certain kind of American novel at a certain point in my reading life and came to feel that was one of the things the novel did well. Mm. Whether I do well or not is not for me to say, but it's something I do. I want to cram in as much, you know, like a sort of pocket Balzac. I do want to get in some bits of Dublin and some bits of Ireland where we are now, you know. So I tried to design White City, for instance, you know, in such a way that it moved my narrator around as many parts of Dublin society as I could.
When you were writing in this, what was it like to write in this kind of time period? I didn't read your story that won the Hennessy Award in 2009. I couldn't find it.
Good.
But I will look. Can you tell me what it was about? Or did you feel like the time period was... I never wrote like during the Celtic Tiger and things like that. I was always observing it because I was in college. I think I wasn't doing much. I feel like...
You were living.
But... I just wonder what it would have been like to be a writer. And it's obviously informed your work, both Bad Day and Black Rock and White City, so hugely. So if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of the main things about the Celtic Tiger, actually, was that everybody was going around saying, why isn't anybody writing about the Celtic Tiger? And they really did that for about 10 years. And then suddenly people started producing novels. I mean, you know, novels, you can't just churn out a novel. And if you do, it's not going to be good novels. So it takes time for that stuff to percolate down.
People get, would you write... That is always the argument, and a lot of like, people are writing about the contemporary moment. And I read a review recently, an LRB review of Alistair Gray's Poor Things, and this argument that came out in like 1992, and then it's so funny to see like a very old review where they're like, and no writers are writing about the contemporary moment. It's just like this constant argument that we have to be writing about what's happening right now all the time. But like you said, like things have to percolate. You have to think about these things, or they need to be in the distance a little bit, you know.
And there are many ways of representing something as well, you know. I mean, people think there's this kind of trend abroad where people seem to think that unless you directly represent something on the screen or on the page, your novel is absolutely about what it's like to be alive right now, but it's set in New York in the 1960s, you know. I mean, and You know, and this annoyed me in seeing a lot of people, some of them supposedly very smart people, complaining that Oppenheimer omits to represent, you know, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the suffering Japanese people. And I was like, it's all there in about 3 minutes. Everything's there in 3 minutes. But it's representing it, you know, metaphorically through kind of the use of quite sophisticated visual metaphor at one point, and then some quite kind of obvious visual metaphors at other points. And I was like, you know, this is how art works, for God's sake.
People are constantly demanding like totally literal representation. Yeah. Like I felt the same when I watched Oppenheimer. I was like, this is how like history is made by these mostly white men, like sitting in a room.
Men in small rooms. Yeah, the Don DeLillo line.
Yeah, discussing things. How can you not see that's the whole point of the movie? And of course, someone comes out and they're like, a woman didn't speak until 20 minutes in. Yeah. I was like, oh, fine. That kind of like push towards the towards representation of like our contemporary lives and things, I disagree with totally. Yep. Like if you're incapable of looking at like a book like that, a book or a film or whatever in it, and you can't read more into it, you really shouldn't be a critic.
They
shouldn't allow you.
I mean, I'm quite sympathetic to social realist fiction.
Yeah.
I am.
And
you know, I think that an almost Tom Wolfe journalistic engagement with the contemporary is a good thing, and we should have some of that. But I mean,
it's not journalism. Do you know?
Not journalism.
That's not the job of a writer.
No.
Sorry, but I will return to the original question before I go off. So writing during the time of the Celtic Tiger and writing short stories, did you feel it was very like formative for you? Did it help you later when you were writing a novel?
I was 26 when I wrote Bad Day in Black Rock.
And you wrote it quite quickly, didn't you?
Embarrassingly quickly, I think.
I've read Bad Day in Black Rock. I read it when I was in the Leopold like years ago. I really, really enjoyed that book.
Thank you. I have not looked at it in quite some time, and I fear to do so. But I'm proud of it. I was motivated by an impulse to get down what I knew of a particular part of Irish society, a particular historical moment, which was the end, and we kind of knew it was the end of the Celtic Tiger when I was writing that book.
Yeah.
And I felt that largely through kind of accidental propinquity, I had been able to collect, not consciously, and then later a bit consciously, you know, kind of social data about a small class of people who hadn't been written about recently, anyway. Russell Caracalli, Paul Howard was doing it and doing it brilliantly.
You wrote a great essay for The Stinging Fly about.
I was really glad to be able to do that because you know I owe him a lot as a writer and just as a reader. I think he brought me such joy over the years with those books. But I also think that those books are. If you want someone to represent contemporary Ireland, he's doing it. He's doing it brilliantly, and it's satire. Mm. But you know, satire tends to be truer than many other kinds of representation. I did have this sense, young idiot that I was, that you know maybe there should be a novel about the Celtic Tiger in some way, and I felt that I could do that because I had this kind of social data that I collected and moral outrage, you know, because I had discovered social class and privilege and inequality by going to UCD and by meeting all these people who had gone to private schools in South Dublin and who I knew then would grow up to be what they have grown up to be, which is ministers, editors of national newspapers, barristers, journalists. You know, I've seen it happen. You know, in the 20 years of my adult life, the people I knew when I was 20 have gone on to do that. And it's kind of rich. I know it's rich thing because here I am. Like I write for the Irish Times and I teach at Trinity. Like I've joined whatever establishment we have. You know, myself to some degree, but I still am deeply skeptical about how it works and how it perpetuates its power, perpetuates its privilege. And I did have a kind of moral mission, or felt I had a moral mission to write about that and expose it. That might sound gauche, but from that gaucheness, I got great energy, great creative energy. And you know, a kind of moral mission of that sort can drive you to write. You can get a lot of pages out of that kind of moral mission.
Anger is such a like a good driving force, but I totally agree with you about the class and every like 5 years or something in Ireland, like we're reminded of them. Reminded that they, they like with the orgy thing, and people are furious. I was like, did you not know?
This is, it's always there, and it never goes away. And it becomes, it's imperfectly concealed. That's the thing. Yeah. Like it becomes, as you say, it becomes visible. Because it's not a secret.
No.
It's an open secret in a way. I mean, this Gore Vidal had a line years ago where people were saying, he was talking about how the, you know, the directors of Goldman Sachs and Chase Manhattan and all these kind of were the same, were just, and there was a revolving door between them and the kind of the White House and the State Department and the Treasury. You know, it was the same people over and over again and the same families. And somebody said, this is kind of paranoid. And he says, well, it's not paranoid. There's no conspiracy. All these people just think alike. Yeah. And that's, that interests me greatly, how they think and how it affects or results in, kind of just perpetuated stratification, social stratification. Yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah, that experience of going to college, and like I think discovering that when you're 18, is so, you know, you'll never kind of forget that.
Yeah.
It won't.
Yeah.
You think you will, and it will continue to reoccur, and might come up in something that you've written in an unexpected place. But I think it's one of the defining moments of your life in some ways.
I think so. And certain writers have that experience and never get over it.
Yeah.
You know, Scott Fitzgerald just never got over going to Princeton and having that experience. And being, you know, trying to get into the clubs. And he wasn't outraged. He was seduced.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he knew that there was something morally suspect about that seduction. And that's kind of what Gatsby is about, and kind of what all of his fiction is about. There are tons of writers who just never get over that, the shock of truly encountering privilege and the kind of class structure for the first time.
And totally, and how power works, you know. So the experience of writing Bad Day in Black Rock, you wrote about it, you wrote a wonderful essay for the Irish Times about writing that book and then the kind of years that followed. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Do I have to?
I always feel like there's one essay or like one thing you say in an interview, and it comes up again and again. I said something about being on the dole in like an interview in The Independent when my first book came out, and ever since then, people have asked me about that, and I'm like, why? Why are people so asking me? So I'm sorry to ask.
I was on the dole when my book came out.
Good. Let's all talk about it.
All good writers should be on the dole at some point. What is it for? You know, why do we pay taxes when we have jobs?
It sounded like I was, like, you know, encouraging people. You should quit your job.
Yeah.
And go on the dole. But that essay is very, very good on kind of the years of, well, on success and how that can be just like disorientating as failure, I think, you know, in many ways. And getting what you want, you know, is such a bad, it's so bad for you, getting
so
what you want.
Yeah, it is. It's horrific, yeah. No one should ever get what they want.
No, I think everything should just be sort of out of reach, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've thought about this a lot, even since writing that piece, and that piece was quite cathartic to write and to publish, because the response I got, that was amazing. People really got in touch with me and just said amazing things, and I was really grateful.
Did you hear from other writers?
Yeah, I did. And not just other writers, lots of people. Yeah, that was amazing. And I think if I could distill what I was trying to get at, it was that to some degree you become a writer because you want to have control over at least some aspect of
control your life. Freaks.
Absolutely,
all of us.
Absolutely, raging control freaks.
Yeah.
And you know, go mad when we feel we don't have control.
Yeah, insane.
But the great irony is that you've got your page.
Yeah,
this gorgeous rectilinear. Mm-hmm. You know, field of action in which you can move words around, and then you hand it over to a bunch of people that you don't know, and then they turn it into a book, and that's okay, that's great.
Yeah.
But then the book goes out there, and you have no control over anything that happens to it past that point. You can't control what reviewers say about it. You can't control how people read it, what they think of you. Yeah. You know, there are people out there who think that I was involved in the death of Brian Murphy, for example. There are people out there who think I went to Black Rock College, and, you know, which I did not. Any of those things. And then, you know, again, you're not supposed to complain about success. You really aren't. It's taboo.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, that's the kind of culture we live in. That's, you know, capitalism. You know, as such, does not, you know, allow you or does not think it's kosher to complain about success.
I just saw something recently about this. So there was a piece in The Guardian about first-time writers. They just found that they weren't, I didn't think they were complaining hugely, although I'm very open to complaining, so maybe I didn't notice. But yep. I think that they were saying that they had like uncomfortable experiences, or it was more, it took more out of them than they expected. And the response online was just harsh, I thought. People were being like, they shouldn't, you know, they should be grateful. I'm so wary when anyone says you should be grateful for anything. Yeah. And I just think there should be a space for that kind of conversation. Certainly, like, you know, like through friends of mine and things, I know people have found it really difficult. And I think that piece was one of the first I read that really acknowledged how hard it can be. To not just, you know, get through it, but also then move on and write another book. And
well, that's the thing, because now you know what happens when you publish a book, and it's not, you know, as fun as you think it is.
Yeah.
Some bits of it are wonderful. They're great. Don't get me wrong. I'm not ungrateful at all. Mm. I'm very grateful to have had the kind of life and career I've had. I wouldn't change any of it, but so far anyway. But
Irish people are obsessed with being grateful.
Yeah.
We are.
Are we?
I'm like, the weather's bad. And my mom's like, you should be grateful to be alive. I'm just saying the weather is bad.
maybe. All right. Maybe I'm not grateful. Maybe I'm really ungrateful. I found that, and I especially found that having it adapted for film really, you know, because that takes it into a world. Because I knew a bit about writing and publishing world, but I did not know how the film world worked. It is a different world, and the rules are different, and the way people operate is different, and what they want is different. I don't want to directly criticize anyone here, but it's a bit colder and more Machiavellian and there's just more money sloshing around, so of course it's like that, you know. That's kind of an inevitable consequence. The stakes in publishing are pretty low. You know,
they just are.
Even the most successful novelists in the world, you know, literary novelists anyway, the financial stakes are still pretty small. Whatever's going on. And that's actually kind of a saving grace in some way. But it gets taken out of your hands. And you can be lucky and you can be unlucky and you can have a good experience, you can have a bad experience. Broadly speaking, I think, looking back, a reasonably good experience, but I still found it totally destabilizing. And then I felt that if I sat down to write, I would just be creating another hostage to fortune, I think. And so that became quite a powerful block, you know. And whatever part of you it is, the unconscious or whatever you want to call it, that gives you real fiction. And you know what I mean when I say that. You can write all day, but it won't be real unless whatever that current is that's giving you the real stuff is switched on. You know, that can get blocked by if you have that fear. If you're writing, if you sit down and your first sort of set of thoughts and feelings are, this is going to create more chaos and surprise and difficulty in my life and it's going to be uncontrollable, why should I do it in the first place? And that's kind of, then if you tell yourself that for long enough, then you stop being able to write properly at all.
Yeah.
And that happened to me, I think, for a good number of years. And I got very depressed. And then I got very anxious. And then I had to just kind of take it all apart and start again. And I started with, I'll do some exercises. You know, like, absolutely, I'm going to be a student here again. I'm going to, you know, start from the beginning. And I did them and I said, I'll try a short story and then I'll try another short story. And then I built back up. Eventually, and that's kind of where I am at again now. I think that's, especially novels are, novels take so long.
In these exercises and things, did you return to short fiction at any point and try and write stories, or did you just
I would do the exercise, and if they sort of seemed to lead somewhere, then I would follow that thread and I would try and write something out of that. And I did, I got some short stories. Some of them were good, some of them were bad. But what I changed was my sense that I needed each piece I wrote to be some sort of final imposition of order on my reality. because that's too much pressure to put on something you're writing. It needs to be more of a kind of made object and you need to give it its due. So it becomes less about you and less about your needs and more about making something to put in the world, something that works and that hopefully resonates with other people. Because when you're in a block of whatever kind, you become a closed loop and it's just yourself. Mm. And so like writing isn't about that. Writing is genuinely trying to give something to people around you, to make an intervention in a community, to speak in within a community. And if you're not doing that, then you're, well, you're just kind of wanking away, really, sadly, in your room.
Writing, I'm great. Yeah. Over and over again.
No, you never write that. You're right. I'm worthless over and over and over again, which is...
I feel, I don't know if this was was your experience. Did you, when you, you know, received the accolades for Bad Day and Black Rock, and you, like you said, you wrote it quite quickly and, you know, that you got good reviews and it, you know, it was translated and it was made into a film and things. Then when you sat down at the desk at Cow, what was your direct relationship with writing? Did you feel I'm worthless, or did you feel, you know, I'm great? Because both seem to be equally damaging, you know? I think if you're sitting down writing, being like, I'm, whatever I put on this page is going to be good, you're so wrong. You're completely wrong, you know? Regardless of what anyone has said about your work in the past. Yeah. So how was it? How was that? Just like sitting there, did it feel...
Both.
Yeah.
That was the thing. And looking back, what I felt was I would sit down and I would write something and I would, with one part of my mind, I would think, this is brilliant, I'm obviously great. And then with another part of my mind, equally clearly, I would think, this is worthless, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
And that's a totally non-negotiable space to be in to write anything. You know, you have to, really what you want is to kind of sink into a state of concentration whereby you're trying to honor the thing itself, you know, to the best degree that you can. And it's not about you at all. Yeah. It's not about whether you think you're great or whether you think you're rubbish.
Yeah.
It is about making the thing as good as it needs to be to be itself. And I think that that's maybe a more zen approach if you can. I mean, it's difficult to achieve, but that's the sweet spot. With criticism, I've never found that. I've always been able to just kind of go, I can write this.
That's what I wanted to ask you about next. So at the you were talking in that essay about moving into criticism then and how that kind of saved, not saved, but certainly helped your process and the way you thought. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you've written a lot of reviews.
And, too many.
You know, how do you find that? How do you find that whole thing?
Well, it's a doddle.
it's a welcome to talk.
I mean, I don't think anybody necessarily plans to become a critic. You know, you do it as a part of being a writer, and I think it's an important part of being a writer. And I look slightly askance at writers who don't review.
Really?
I do. I do. I think it's sort of part of the job. And I think that there's an obligation to take part in. Again, it's about the community. You're speaking into a community, and if you're, you know, if you want to repair to the remote slopes of Olympus and occasionally dispatch your sort of, you know, carefully wrought manuscript, that's one way of doing it. But I do think that, you know, you have a certain obligation to just think about what's going on. Yeah. And reviewing is, even an 800-word book review for a newspaper is part of a conversation about books and about values and about what you think is important. So I've always liked reviewing and liked having that conversation. But I found that I just found that in writing criticism, and I started doing kind of longer pieces right about the same time I was going back to the drawing board with fiction, I was able to actually get better, I thought, or at least longer at writing criticism. And I found that I was able to do it without any of the emotional, you know, snarled up emotional stuff that was kind of getting in the way of writing fiction. And that's because it's less immediately demanding of imaginative investment, criticism, and it is more about thinking. And you know, look, I've been an academic for much of my adult life, and I therefore have a certain amount of training at thinking. Whether or not I'm good at it is again not for me to say, but I have some training in literary criticism, and I found that I was good at it and that I liked it, or at least I thought I was good at it. And
you are good.
Well, thank you. So are you.
On the podcast.
And I found it really rewarding.
Yeah.
And I still find it really rewarding. In fact, I think I find it too rewarding because I think it takes up too much of my writing time now.
How did you find your way into it? Did you? Was it like one person asked you to review, or do you just got in?
When Bad Day and Black Rock came out, two editors asked me to review for them, more or less around the same time. It was kind of late 2008, I think. One was the late and much missed Caroline Walsh from the Irish Times, brilliant books editor of the Irish Times. And the other was Nadine O'Regan, who is books editor at the Sunday Business Post. And really, I wrote for the Sunday Business Post almost weekly for I'd say nearly a decade. And during that time, I read a lot of books I wouldn't have read otherwise. Yeah. And I found that incredibly useful, yeah. Really incredibly useful. And there's a lot to be said for being issued books to read and then asked to make judgments on them, because yeah. I think that really gets you thinking about what makes a book good, what makes a book bad.
And you're engaging with contemporary fiction. Yeah. I feel like, you know, some writers are like, I don't read contemporary fiction. But I think you should read contemporary fiction. This, like you said, this is part of the conversation you're having. You shouldn't read exclusively contemporary fiction. You absolutely should read to your own taste. But I think you should have a knowledge of what your peers are doing.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the really useful thing about writing criticism can be. But I also feel when I taught a criticism class once, and they were MAs, so they were about 23, 24. I just gave them sort of like little exercises and things to do. And it was so useful because, you know, it was a process of them figuring out their own taste. I was like, I don't think you can write until you figure out your own taste.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's not valued enough. In a sort of sad way, you can see that very much now, where everything is algorithmically like decided, that people are not like figuring out what they like. So a process of sitting down and writing 2,000, 3,000 words about why you think of a book is valuable is really like deciding. I think that's just like a useful thing to do in life, regardless of it, you know, either being about writing or earning money or whatever. I think it can be an important thing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, what do we have to judge our own sentences except taste? And, you know, if your taste is the kind of given taste of your moment, you know, which is, you know, to some degree, maybe algorithmically determined, I think you're going to end up writing like everybody else, you know? So that's, I think that's risky. And I think that the writers who stick with me anyway, are writers who have really strong, obvious taste. And this is why I like writers who are also critics, because to some degree, they have made that exact journey that you've talked about, that they have developed their taste. It's all about, like, I bought a second copy of Mary McCarthy's literary essays recently, and I was reading through it. I read it before years ago, but she's a phenomenal critic. And she was writing about J.D. Salinger, and she did not care for J.D. Salinger's Glass family stories. But the reasons she gives for that are incredible. Like, she really, really works out according to the, you know, aesthetic standards that she herself holds. You know, and explains to you why Franny and Zooey, for example, is rubbish. it's exhilarating to read. And, you know, I like Mary McCarthy's fiction. I wouldn't claim actually that she's as good a fiction writer as J.D. Salinger, but what she was someone who had thought brilliantly about her own taste. And so she was able to, when Pale Fire, the Nabokov novel, came out in 60, what was it, 5, 7, 6, 7, she was able to write about it for the New York Review of Books and tell you, the reader of that essay, exactly what Nabokov is doing in that novel, which is a difficult novel, and it needs that kind of elucidation. And she was, you know, she, first of all, her taste was good enough to know when she was looking at a masterpiece, and second of all, her technical knowledge was good enough to be able to explain that masterpiece to its initial readers. And I think that's really important. I think that's a really important thing to do.
No, it is. I really enjoy reading writers' criticism. I've read some of Graham Greene's film criticism, and you can tell.
Like, I haven't read that. I should.
Oh, it's really good. But yeah, you can tell what he likes and what he doesn't like, and then it is reflected in, or Hilary Mantel's.
Oh, she's phenomenally good. Yeah,
her criticism. Yeah. You know, or Anne Enright's.
Also, a phenomenal critic. Yeah.
I think it's extremely, extremely valuable. How do you find the contemporary critical moment?
I mean, it is rich, is it not? Ryan Ruby, the American critic, just had a piece recently where he said we're living in a golden age of criticism, and he listed 50 critics, were doing really work that was worth reading, and like that list wasn't even close to complete. You know, in a way, one of the side benefits of the internet, which is obviously destroying civilization in various ways, but one of the things it's been really good for is criticism, because there's a wider range of venues than ever. They're publishing, you can publish to whatever length you desire in many, many places. And there are people out there who are doing really, really good thinking about, about works of art, about contemporary fiction, about contemporary film, about whatever you name it, good cultural criticism. Yeah, and I think there are, you know, there's almost too much of it to kind of get through.
Yeah.
And you see, there's quite a long list of people I follow on Twitter, and if I see they've got a new piece, I say, all right, I'll open that tab and I'll read it later. And so my phone has like 120 tabs of like essays that I haven't got to yet, but I know they'll be worth reading when I do. Obviously, you and I are the best current, you know, functioning critics, but
I think that's why we're here.
Yeah.
But I do want to ask you about a piece you wrote for the Stinging Fly, which was great and very interesting. I hadn't seen it done before. It was about Megan Nolan's Acts of Desperation, but it was sort of overview of the reviews of Megan Nolan's Acts of Desperation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can't really take credit for that idea. That was Tom Morris, who's the wonderful one of the wonderful editors of Stinging Fly. He pulls all our strings.
Or anything that happens in Irish.
Well, what happened there was I was late, I was meant to just review it at about kind of 1,500 words, but I did not read the book and then was very late with the review. Yeah. And by that stage, everyone else had already reviewed it. And Tom kind of said, and I agreed, what's the point in just doing another, you know, here's this book, here's what it's doing, is it good, is it bad? And he said, why don't you do a more kind of meta thing and review the reviews? So I did. And that was instructive, partly because if you kind of assemble all the reviews of what I think is a good book, that novel, Acts of Desperation, you get a case study in what reviewing can do and what it can't do. And one of the things that it can do is open up avenues of thinking and taste, you know, written book. But one of the things that it can't do actually really is help the writer of the novel. I don't know if you find this, but reading a good review of your work, you kind of go, yeah. Mm. But reading a bad review of it, you think, oh no, that's it. That's it. That's right. Yeah. That's true.
That's not how you feel.
That's not how you feel. No, okay. All your good reviews are.
I read the bad reviews, and I just write the critic's name down in a little notebook.
That's a good idea. I should do. Like, you're like Richard Nixon. Little enemies list.
Yeah. I'm like Nixon in a lot of ways.
In many ways. It's worrying. I'm glad I gave you a good review now.
But that, I think, even, you know, you're going through in that essay, you're going through the language of used around Megan Nolan's book, and I found that really interesting. Like the words that the descriptor is like attached to Megan's books, and the language we use generally for reviewing, and that's sort of fascinating.
I mean, did you get called whip smart?
I'm sure somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll consult my notebook.
Because I'm a man and therefore cannot be whip smart. Oh, that is, you know,
that's a shame.
It is a shame. Yeah. It's devastating to me. But if female writers, that's all. And if you think about that for a minute, like, why are we gendering the language of our, even the blurbs are being, that's still there. At a moment, you know, when I think literary fiction by women across the board is kind of unprecedentedly dominant in the marketplace and in the culture. Still all this kind of little, you know, these little gendered, you know, things are going on there. I've never seen a novel by a man called Whipsmart. Mm. It's only been by a woman, and it's only been by a young woman. It's like this, and isn't there a kind of condescension there? You know, why shouldn't it be? It's a novel. Like, this is a surprisingly intelligent novel by a woman.
Who would have thought?
And so it's you can start to look at these quite small, these kind of the cliches that are floating around in book reviewing, and God knows book reviewing is. Mm. Not criticism, those long critical essays are one thing, but like book reviews of the shorter, you know, newspaper kind of scale are, you know, little hothouses of cliche. And it can be useful to kind of track through those cliches how we currently think about books and writing and other things as well.
I think people think of book criticism, you know, in this sort of like completely separate to novels and writing. Mm. But for me, the best criticism is the same as a novel or a short story, which is, it shows me sort of something different about the world, or it kind of elucidates an idea that I might have had but wasn't able to you know, phrase myself or whatever. So like I feel they're not that separate. I remember when I was teaching it, I was trying to communicate that to them. And the critics that I find most interesting are the ones that are where the language is still interesting. There's something alive about the writing, and it's extremely hard to do that in like a a shorter piece, I think, you know, in 900 words, when you have like 4,000 words, you have more space or whatever. But yeah, I feel the criticism kind of excite me in the same way that like a novel or a story can. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Me too. That's the question of language. You know, critics tend not to get credit for that.
Yeah, of course.
There's a great book came out a few years ago by a guy called Craig Seligman, and it's called Sontag and Kael, Opposites Attract Me. And it's about Sontag and Pauline Kael, his two favorite critics. Mm. And he was kind of one of the, what do they call it? The Paulettes. One of the kind of these young male film critics who worship Pauline Kael and kind of came up under her umbrella, and she sponsored them. And kind of, he was one of them. So he knew Kael personally. He didn't know Sontag. But in it, he talks about exactly what you're talking about. He says he reads them as stylists.
Yeah.
As incredibly sophisticated users of language, and quite different ones. Mm-hmm. You know, Sontag is austere, you know, distilled kind of epigrammatic, whereas Kael is kind of jazzy and jivey and slangy and demotic. I haven't seen it done often, you know, to read critics as artists in that way, as stylists.
But I think
way.
they deserve to be read in that way.
Yeah.
Actually, I watched that Robert Altman film, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, a little while ago. Great film. And afterwards, there was like a little clip of Pauline Kael going on that show that we kind of show in the US.
Dick Cavett.
And talking about the film. Mm. And this is the idea that a critic, like this was however many years ago, that a critic could go on mainstream television show and talk about this, like a filmmaker that she admired and was like defending and like encouraging the general public to go and see this film. Like, I do feel that, and Sontag had a similar role, that decline of the critic's role has in culture has happened, you know. I don't think there is that one defining voice that you're like, I will always read them on everything, do you know?
Yeah, it was James Wood, the last critic, to kind of have that role where we all read him, you know, no matter what he was reviewing. And he pointed, I'm talking about him in the past tense, obviously he's still very much alive and practicing and writing for the New Yorker. But to me, it seems in the last, say, for five even years, his centrality and his capacity to point people and quite large numbers of readers towards a new writer, which he did with Emer McBride, for example, and tons of writers. There's so many writers you could name people read, you know, read because James Wood wrote about them. He did kind of the first big piece on Knausgaard and he did all this kind of stuff. But he was still very much, you know, a literary phenomenon, James Wood. You know, he talked to readers and writers within a relatively small community of literary fiction. He didn't go beyond it the way Sontag, go beyond it the way Sontag did. And Kael writing about movies had a built-in kind of mass appeal anyway. I don't know. We appear to be in a little gap of...
I think that because the internet annoys people now, you know, like they're like, this is the popular thing. Mm. So the critic doesn't necessarily have that opportunity anymore. No one is like, well, actually, I read this great review of this book in the New Yorker. It's more like, well, this book was on Book Talk or whatever. Yeah. Like, I feel like that, and I miss that. I really like that one voice that I trust being like, okay, I will make sure and see that this weekend, or I'll make sure and read that.
Yeah, there are. Yeah. There are fewer. I mean, I like Richard Brody for The New Yorker. He's a very good film critic.
I really enjoy Richard.
And he hated Oppenheimer. I just read his Oppenheimer.
And he loved Barbie.
I haven't seen Barbie, so I haven't read reviews of it either. So I'm going to see it, I hope, next week. But reading again, a Richard Brody, you know, pan is going to teach me something. Yeah. And it taught me.
And also a good stylist. A.S. Hammer is a film critic I always read. Have you ever read?
No, I don't.
A really good stylist. Okay. The reviews are always very funny. Kind of go to weird places and things, but I really enjoy reading his film criticism. Mm. But once again, like I said, you learn something that when you feel that the thing you saw, whether you liked it or you didn't, has been illuminated in like some new way. I think I will always, I feel like I will continue to write criticism, you know, and I, even after like publishing the book and everything, I wrote something recently and I was like, that was really great. It was really useful for me to do that. And useful in other ways too, because, you know, for the longer reviews, like you write yourself, you read everything. You read everything. So it's such an education. And I really am, like, you see the writers you admire, their failures. Mm. And that's
very
great.
Useful. Yeah, useful. Very
like,
useful.
You only ever hear of these one or two books, but like actually, you're like, you know, they had two or three that were total misses.
Yeah.
And like they needed to write these misses to get to the good ones.
Yeah.
And I find that so interesting.
It's so reassuring.
Yeah,
because,
is.
You know, there's something quite comforting about looking at what you've already done and thinking, oh, that was all just apprentice work. Of, you know, my great work still awaits me.
Yeah. And everything was sort of there, but not quite right.
Yeah. That's why I look back at some early Cormac McCarthy's recently and I felt that, you know, obviously there's so much of the style is there in the early books, but they're also kind of a slog. I don't know. I probably shouldn't speak too ill of poor Cormac. But like The Orchard Keeper and Child of God and stuff, there's some amazing bits in them. But like, you know, then you get, he does Blood Meridian, you know, as novel number 5, I think.
Yeah.
And then he's Cormac McCarthy and you kind of go, those first four novels were, you know, necessary failures, not quite the word, but you know, necessary misses, I suppose.
Yeah. It's good to know these things. So are you working on short stories at the moment? Are you working on something new?
I am. I'm trying to write short stories. Trying to figure out the short story. You tell me, what's the secret? Well, I have you.
I've forgotten.
That's not helpful.
The thing I always say about the short story that I find, you know, joyous when I write them and things is how perfect you can get it. Like someone like listening to this might be like, your stories aren't perfect, but they're, it's like children. Yeah. They're perfect to me. Like,
yes.
You can get a level of like a novel. It necessarily has to be baggy in some ways, and a thing, you know, there has to be boring sentences and there has to be all these kind of things that you feel when you read any novel. There's going to be a paragraph where you're like, oof, or like nothing happens, or but in a story everything can be it's so intense. It's like, yeah, everything can be amazing. It can be dazzling. And a novel just doesn't feel that way to me.
Yeah, novels that try to do that rapidly kind of tire you out.
They're tiring.
Yeah.
So stories. Have you reread any of your stories from your...
No, I have not. I'm trying to figure out... One of the reasons I was drawn to Emer's story was that it's about family. And the older I get, the more I feel that... When a writer says, you know, the only subject is blank, that means that that's the subject they're now thinking about. Basically. But that's what I mean when I say the only subject is family. I want to... You know, I have kids myself now and I'm acutely involved in the question of how a family dynamic shapes us. To what extent that's writable about, I'm now curious. I'm much less interested, I think, in my own subjectivity. I don't want to say this is a consequence of becoming a parent, but one of the things that does happen when you become a parent is that you actually stop feeling like the protagonist of life. Up to a point, you're still narcissistic and self-involved, obviously, to various degrees. But there is a very odd feeling of you know, up till now, I've been the main character of whatever, you know, ridiculous production, theatrical production this is. But now it's not me; it's the kids, and I'm hoping that I can cobble together some form of maturity out of that feeling, and sort of go well. How would that work in fiction? And it would mean displacing kind of, you know, the my own, you know, ways of seeing a bit and trying to get into other minds a bit better. I think that's in writing the short stories, I'm consciously, I don't know how much of it is ever conscious, but I am trying to urge it towards being about people who aren't like me in various ways. In small ways, you know, I'm not going to write about a, you know, Arctic explorer, you know,
what?
Because I don't want to go to the Arctic. I don't want to do that kind of research.
I don't want to explore.
I just don't want to. No, it's not too cold. And I think that the short story is a safer scale to operate to do that, because I feel whenever I write a short story, I feel it's an experiment, you know, because I don't feel that I have a necessary grasp of what the form does.
There's a freedom to it as well, because, you know, you're like, well, I've got 5 or 6 pages. It's not the huge, I need to do this 200-something page novel in this deadline, you know. You've got a little bit more, it's a little bit more relaxed, I think. And I often find that I put less pressure on myself when I feel less tense when I'm writing a story.
Writing novels is very tense. You're tense for the whole time you're doing it as well. It's like braced.
And you're thinking about it all the time.
All the time.
Which is sort of useful, I think, if you're... When I wrote my novel, it was during COVID a lot of the time, and people were like, it's awful and we can't go out. And obviously that annoyed me so much. But I was like, my mind isn't here. Which was incredible. It felt like a gift.
Yeah.
I said, my mind is like in the 1960s, partly. And I think that was it made that experience so different for me.
Did you listen to a lot of 60s music and watch a lot of kind of 60s movies and stuff?
That was my research. But I think that, I feel like not being fully present in my own life is great.
That's the best. It's the best you can hope for, really.
I think we should leave it at that. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Nicole. That's our advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was a pleasure. A big thank you to Kevin for joining us on the podcast today. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. If you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. We'll be back next month with another writer reading a story from the Stinging Fly archive. Access to the Stinging Fly's full archive is available to anyone who subscribes to the magazine and to our patrons. Taking out a subscription is a great way to support what we do. Subscribe at stingingfly.org. I want to thank the Arts Council, who provide funding for this podcast, and for everything else that the Stinging Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish, and promote the very best new writers in new writing. Thank you for listening.